Good afternoon, folks. Welcome to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz here on the controls.
Yes, control. Very important.
Bass to control. Give me some volume.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Today, we will address the terror attacks in Paris and how the erroneous reporting that they were in part perpetrated by Syrian refugees will have a negative effect on getting those poor souls out of harm's way. And can Prime Minister Trudeau stay the course with his election promise to bring 25,000 to Canada by the end of the year? Then, Paul Bernardo, he's been in prison for almost 25 years for the brutal rape and murder of two Ontario teens, and now he wants to be known as a novelist. Amazon had his book, his ebook available, but has since taken it down. It is called A Mad World Order, and Amazon bowed to public pressure, but we'll play devil's advocate and ask, should they have? And then finally, we will look at local matters and the Guelph budget. For the umpteenth year in a row, the Royal City is facing tough decisions, some of which have already garnered some controversy. What will Guelph's financial outlook look like in 2016? But first, and it's kind of weird that when we started the show in January, the first topic was about a terrorist attack in Paris, and now here we are at the end of the year with the exact same topic at hand. As I'm sure you've heard, a series of coordinated attacks erupted in the French capital almost 1 week ago as of tomorrow. Since then, Parisian law enforcement and worldwide intelligence agencies have been trying to find the perpetrators. In terms of breaking news, I think the most late-breaking thing was they reported that the mastermind behind the attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud, was killed in a police raid this morning. And there's been numerous reports of further attempts, that there was a cell that was broken up yesterday that was on the verge of being ready to institute an attack. Meanwhile, there's been a reflexive action across world governments, with President Obama in particular trying to encourage world leaders to step up in the fight against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, we're all caught in the middle, waiting to see what happens, waiting to see if these kind of attacks are the new normal, Scotty.
Well, that sounds like there are two, and you should mention that it's not just France that's most recently been attacked, but also there was an attack in a place called Yola, Nigeria, in a marketplace, and that was Boko Haram militants who are, you know, of kindred spirits, let's say. They're not directly related to ISIS, but it's the same. Their MO is the same. And also in Beirut. And, of course, when this first happened, Beirut, Lebanon, there was talk that, oh, why is there so much focus on Paris? Why are they focusing on all these attacks? If you look hard enough and you're like we do and follow the news wires, it's all out there. I think the main reasons why they focused on Paris specifically is because you're more likely to find yourself in Paris than you would Beirut, Lebanon, or Yola, Nigeria. That's not to diminish those places at all. And equally as serious, but it's 84 million people, tourists, go to France a year. It's like the number one tourist destination. So,
and in terms of media concentration as well, where are you going to find more reporters in Paris or Beirut?
Oh, for sure. Paris, most definitely. And so that's what happened there. But it's something else. And then, of course, there's rumors and talk of that there's a potential that there's going to be chemical attacks being planned. I think what we're seeing here and what it reminds me of is post 9/11, right? Mm. So it's not just the fact that there's going to be more attacks, and there were attacks that were thwarted, but this, obviously, worst-case scenario since Charlie Hebdo. And since World War II, I think they said specifically, and will there be more? In all likelihood, yes. But it's something that should also be mentioned, which you sort of see here and there, but not specifically, is that all of these terrorists were from the EU. They may have been of different origin, let's say, but they were either French nationals or Belgian. And, of course, there's this, well, it's not really the strange Belgian connection, but there's this weird kind of crossover from a particular area in Belgium, let's say, an area that has a concentration. What's the neighborhood again? I've completely lost the name. I had it on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But particular neighborhoods that have a higher concentration of I keep calling them militants, but ISIS, Daesh sympathizers, let's say. And the chase is on. I mean, France has pretty much said that they're at war with these people, and they're not going to stop. And there has also been talk of possible use of NATO's Article 5, which is when somebody in NATO is, and this may happen. It's entirely possible that it will happen. Once you declare Article 5, it's that, and you're a member of NATO, you have to come to the defense of the the country or the nation that's under threat. And will we see that? It's entirely possible. If they can't come up with a coalition of sorts to take them on that's based a bit stronger than this sort of loosely based who's, you know, it's a hodgepodge right now.
Yeah, I mean, these weren't, although I think a couple of them did receive training abroad in Yemen, in terms of going to a training camp of some sort. But yeah, mostly by and large, these were local people raised locally with local connections and launching this attack. And the one Syrian passport they found was pretty readily cast out of hand as a fake. In terms of the forgery of it, it was pretty obvious fake and that. But yeah, this was my first thought was as the attacks were unfolding on Friday was how long would it be before the conspiracy theorists start talking about people sneaking in with refugees, and B, how much longer after that would it take for the truth to be revealed, which is more likely that it is some of these disenfranchised Muslim youths who are, in fact, from all over Europe, from one end to the other, practically ghettoized amongst the European population. And I think as much as the Charlie Hebdo attacks was a reminder of those kind of views. This was even scarier in its way that just how, I mean, the Charlie Hebdo attacks were a couple of people. This was a highly coordinated attack across multiple targets and big targets too. The Stade de France, the Vatican Theater, these very well-known eateries and restaurants. It's almost stunning the chutzpah of it, I guess to use maybe the wrong word, but
no, that's yeah, it's the gall, I would say, but yeah, and that's it too, and that's what makes it so hard to take in. It's like this is how they work. It's just to cause as much chaos as possible. And it's part of their MO, I think, simply because the way they work is like they cause all this chaos. And by the sounds of it, they really, really want to be persecuted and beat on. So by doing this, it's kind of like, you know, you're going to beat this guy up, so then everybody's going to hate you. I wouldn't necessarily call it self-loathing, but they're what drives them it seems to me, at least, the desire to be hated. And we do something like, especially attacking innocents, anything like this. And thankfully, in some ways, the attack on the stadium failed. And I don't know if it's because the president was there for the game, the security was enhanced. I mean, enhanced security is on all over it, since 9/11, probably. And obviously since Charlie Hebdo attacks as well, specifically in France. And there's been talk of, oh, there's the shortcomings of the, you know, they're not going to be able to stop everything. Specifically because of the way these guys work.
Right.
Like a lot of the traffic isn't on the radar. You can follow Twitter or whatever all you like. It seems Anonymous has their backs now in terms of finding things out, and they will. I mean, you know, that's just sort of a bit of a side story. But as you were saying, though, Molenbeek is the, and I did that without looking at the internet, by the way, where the police raids were in Belgium, And this is the thing that's the, I guess they call it the Banilo, the sort of perimeter. You have Paris proper, where everybody goes to see the Eiffel Tower and that. Then there's this sort of donut shape around it where the immigrant communities are. Mm-hmm. Unemployment super high. Yeah. And they're, in some ways, they are kind of closed neighborhoods in that it's not really, say, along the lines of the Canadian model, where it's, I mean, sorry, it's not completely fair to say that in terms of Paris, France, definitely a multicultural city if there ever was one, but there are pockets of, like, let's just say non-integrated, where there, you know, there isn't a crossover to the community. It's sort of a closed system. And of course, when that happens and there's high unemployment, we do see things like this. I'm not saying that it's exclusively the reasons why this happens, but where these attacks have originated from have been from neighborhoods of this description.
Yeah.
And there's several factors in place, the root causes, let's say, plus, you know, if you've got nothing going for you, radicalization can be fairly simple. And even mm-hmm. if you think about, I was thinking too of the Tsarnaev brothers,
right.
The same kind of thing. It's like you have this
yeah.
kind of, there's, because it was three brothers were involved in this attack, right?
Yeah.
So there is family connection, there's all these kinds of things add up to this. And of course, we're not going to solve it here in 10, 15 minutes as to what's going on, but we're, you know, you need to look at these factors other than just, we're going to go and bomb them. And that, you know, it's an understandable response
yeah.
that they sent the jets, but it sounds like from different reports I was reading that the results on the ground are mixed. They're bombing empty places, they're bombing civilians. It's almost inevitable that that's going to happen. So, but it's just like the anger reaction is strike back right away. As to whether what the results were, has it squashed ISIS? No. So, I mean, that's...
Well, that is the problem, because you're talking about guys, I mean, basically, they're not joining ISIS out of some great surge of what you would typically call patriotism to... you know, the Islamic State. They are disenfranchised. It's basically brainwashing. It's brainwashing by social media and by using your economic conditions as a way to point out just how, you know, effed you are in terms of where you live in the modern world. And they tell you that the West and the elites and the infidels are to blame for your lot in life. And it becomes very compelling. It's like cult brainwashing in the 70s. The thing is, when you're talking about these kinds of attacks, and young men who are basically armed with guns, nothing terribly sophisticated, Kalashnikovs, bombs made with homemade chemicals, you're not following the Acme delivery truck around town trying to see where it's dropping off all its evil bombs and weapon making supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in their basements or in their apartments or wherever, you know, cooking this up. Meanwhile, to bring this back to the 9/11 reference and what you were saying, you have Francois Hollande coming out and first of all calling it an act of war. Well, an act of war against who? Like a bunch of teenagers and guys in their 20s. Then he's calling for changes to the French Constitution to make it easier for security personnel to do their jobs. I think after 9/11 and after the experience of the Patriot Act and all that stuff, anytime a leader says they want to crack open the Constitution to make it easier for security to do their jobs, we should be highly skeptical. And yeah, I realize people are scared about, you know, what's going on the ground there. And, you know, each day when each new police raid, when, you know, the one yesterday where they found the guys basically ready to go with another wave, yeah, that stuff's scary. But in the long term, what's really scary is how much world leaders seem to want to throw away in the name of mm-hmm. protection sometimes. And as you were saying too, is the bombing working? ISIS, there's been a heavy bombing campaign against ISIS for a year. Does ISIS seem weaker to anyone?
No.
Yeah.
And the thing too with the raid on the apartment, they found them. I mean, they found
yeah.
that's it's not that long after, and they found the guy, and I think they arrested eight people in that, and two died, one of whom was the alleged or so-called mastermind,
mm-hmm.
and a woman who blew herself up. So what mm-hmm. are you just like waiting with the vest for these guys to come, and then you're just going to martyr yourself in your flat? Like it's so incredibly warped,
yeah,
that it doesn't make sense, this whole, you know, quest for martyrdom, because the bombers outside the stadium, among other places. And there's some interesting footage emerged today of inside one of the cafes when this guy just started firing. And that's AK-47 is a fairly insidious weapon in that it just goes and goes and goes. They don't, you know, if you have loads of ammunition ready to go, this thing doesn't quit. It just, you know, it's not, it's probably one of the, well, it is, I think it's been labeled the most deadly firearm ever.
Yeah.
And they're cheap and they're easy to get. And it's, but this is, I mean, you know, the crackdown is on. You were talking about constitutional things, but I mean, it's on anyway. If you've been on the internet and been remotely pro ISIS or anything, your card is marked. Like, they're coming for you. So, will that change how they work? Possibly. They might go back to other, you know, less technologically based methods.
Right.
But, I mean, that's, you know, it's on. It's totally on.
And just to bring it back to Canada for a sec, there's been a gut reaction here. Mosque in Peterborough burned to the ground. Mm-hmm. I think it was deliberate. There was a new report yesterday. Two women in hijabs were assaulted at the Sherbourne subway station. You know, terrible comments and shoving involved in that. A woman harassed in front of her child's school wearing a niqab. And then this idiot Jesse Peltier in Montreal, who made a video talking about killing one Arab a week while wearing a Joker mask and then getting arrested and saying, no, wait, it was a joke. Don't think anybody's laughing,
some
Jesse.
Joke, yeah. Well, I mean, you obviously recall after 9/11, similar things happened. Mosques burning to the ground.
Yeah.
And, of course, in this neck of the woods, the most ridiculous one is the Hindu temple in Kitchener getting stoned.
Yeah.
Like people throwing stones or bricks, whatever, through the window. And I think, wasn't it post 9/11 that was a Hindu temple leveled in Hamilton? Like,
yeah.
These racists can't even get it right. It's like, let's just go after the brown people. Oh, no, they're wearing cloths where people don't normally wear them. Let's get them. You guys are idiots.
Yeah.
I mean, they just don't get it. They obviously need some schooling when it comes to that. But this happens every time. It's this sort of knee-jerk reaction. It's like, let's punish them. Or was it in Texas or whatever where a Koran ripped up and somebody defecated on the steps of a mosque? And, of course, the story is today some kid gave his piggy bank or whatever to help them fix up whatever had happened or what had gone wrong. So it's one of those stories that you hear where it's from the bad, something good comes out of it.
Yeah, and the Peterborough Mosque had a crowdfunding site to make money for repairs and rebuilding, and I think they had a goal of $80,000, and they achieved it in a day. So that's another, you know, there are people who get it, and it's unfortunately that there seem to be so many people who don't get it. And, you know, if you're wearing a headscarf or you go to a mosque, clearly we are lumping you in with a group of people who, you know, have about as much in common with fellow moderate with moderate Muslims as you know, pedophiles in the Catholic Church have with people who go to church every Sunday.
Yeah, so the ignorance is unbelievable. Of course, it's spreading in terms of affecting the whole approach to refugees, and that, you know, as we say in the media sometimes, people are saying, but, you know, Brad Wall and some others saying that, oh, we need to cut back, we need to sort of throttle back in the amount of refugees that we're taking. I think it was this past week that the first plane load arrived in the UK. I think it was in Scotland. There was a plane load of refugees arrived. The UK is taking on 20,000 people, I think, over 4 years, which is a bit of a measured response. But the goal of 25,000 in Canada before Christmas is making some people nervous. Some people, I mean, right. Brad Wall and some others. You know, they shouldn't, you know, and this is when this stuff kind of surfaces, like, they shouldn't be coming here, blah, blah, blah. it is an ambitious goal, and I think it was Rona Ambrose is along, you know, she's not saying don't bring any refugees at all. And I don't even think Brad Wall is implying that they shouldn't, but I think Rona Ambrose had said that they need to share the plan, because that seems to be what's missing from the Liberal plan. It's like, okay, we're going to bring 25,000 refugees by Christmas, which isn't that far away. What is it, like 40-something days now? Yeah. I saw the chalkboard in the mall or whatever. well, you know, that's the only reason. That's the only way you know. But, yeah, is it a bit rushed? It might be. And I think what we're going to see now is that there'll be some sort of bureaucratic thing that they'll refer to that well, we can't actually do it because of this. Like, we don't have this in place. I've got a feeling that that's going to be the out. I really don't think we're going to see 25,000 Syrian-specific refugees coming before the new year. And I think they're just going to find an out somehow. Like, well, the structures aren't in place that we see, you know, the fact-checking and the double-checking. So, and I don't think, you know, people aren't against that, yeah. I don't think. It might not hurt to take a little bit more time to do it. But the tone is that, oh, we don't know because there's terrorists coming, right? That's the tone. It's kind of implied that, like...
I never thought they were going to bring 25,000 refugees by the end of the year. I thought it was highly aspirational, like when you say, like, I'm going to work out for the next 100 days, and then you start skipping days. I think it wasn't really going to happen in the first place, but I think you're right that the plan needs to be shared at some point rather than just having, you know, Ralph Goodale come out saying we're going to make it happen. I like the gusto, I like the enthusiasm, but
yeah.
To the Prime Minister's credit and to the government's credit, the RCMP and CSIS have both come out and supported the intention, and I guess there's two groups you want on side, and amongst heavy security concerns, it's probably those two groups. There's been a lot of, I don't know, false concern. I think it's false because when they talk about who are we bringing in, we're bringing in women, we're bringing in children, we're bringing in whole families, we're bringing in seniors, not typically the isolated young males in their 20s who are likely to be ISIS sympathizers. Or
just young males in their 20s running from unspeakable things, right?
Yeah. But this isn't being done out of whole cloth either. This has been the background and the vetting. It's an 8-step process to get from where you're going.
Eight. I thought it was two, but 8.
It's an 8-step process from leaving your country to arriving in Canada when you're a refugee, and that includes medical checks, that includes security checks, that includes talking to the UN, that includes talking to Canada, that includes waiting around for paperwork to get done, and it's not like a okay, everybody on the plane, you're going to Canada. We'll check your credentials later. We just want to get the plane off the ground. There is an actual process here. And, I know people don't have much faith in the government. Sometimes that's for legitimate reasons. But I think you have to have faith in this kind of process because it's not happening in a void. There are international agencies involved. There are other countries involved. And although, the 25,000 mark is aspirational, it's not a situation where, you know, they're just going to be, you know, bringing people in. It's like, come on, guys, we got to get you in because it's December 31st.
The door is closing.
At 8 p.m. We got 4 hours and we need 6,000 more people.
The peace tower is chiming. Hurry up. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems a little, I don't know, a little overboard to say this is a bad plan. First of all, we don't know what the plan is. And second of all, they aren't inventing the plan out of whole cloth either.
No, and back to Bradwell. So I assure you this is the last I'll say his name. But his comment was, you know, if you rush the process, he said, it could be devastating.
Yeah.
That implies that somebody is on a plane with a vest or a pop can bomb ready to blow it up. And I don't think that's the case at all. It's a remote possibility.
Or shoes filled with plastique.
Yeah, exactly. The shoe bomber, or whatever you want. Let's go back to Paris and Belgium. Where did the attackers come from? They're in-house.
Yeah.
So those aren't the people that are risking their lives in the Aegean, in the sea, mm-hmm. to come to get away. So you have to have some faith that the process is going to work. And it was interesting, Nicolas Chapuis, who is the French envoy to Canada, had said that you can't just blame these people for everything. And this is somebody, you know, he's from France. Mm-hmm. Because they're fleeing the barbarians, they're not. They aren't necessarily the barbarians. There is the possibility.
Yeah.
But you would hope through the vetting process that possibility is examined, and anybody who is even remotely a risk is eliminated from coming.
And France affirmed yesterday that they're going to take 30,000 refugees over the next 2 years, which is about the same number as the United States. in terms of those numbers. So even as we were talking about France, hunkering down and getting their security in order, they still recognize the need. I mean, these were the people who were attacked, not us, and even they recognize that that these people still need help, and these people deserve to be helped. And what is heartening too, mentioning about outreach and charity, Nova Scotia set up a line where you dial 211 to find out how you can help incoming Syrian refugees. And they were, as soon as they announced that this line had been set up, they were flooded with calls from people. I see posts on social media where, how can I help? Where can I donate winter clothes? This kind of thing. So there's a lot of people who are ready to receive refugees with outstretched hands. And I think there's actually a meeting at one of the churches here in town on Tuesday.
Dublin United.
Yeah, I think so. About how people can get involved with helping Syrian refugees, perhaps coming to Guelph. So I mean, there's a lot of BS out there coming from people like, Bradwell, people like half the governors of the United States.
Republican candidates.
Mike Pence, Republican presidential candidates.
Grown.
People like Indiana Governor Mike Pence, who there was a Syrian family due to be settled in Indianapolis, but he had them relocated to Connecticut,
One family. Now, think of the scope of this. We're saying the government's saying 25,000 people are going to come here by, or whenever. 25,000. Sounds like a lot of people, right? Right now, there are 4.2 million refugees from Syria alone, and there are 7.6, something like that, million people displaced internally in Syria, which means they are refugees to be. So that's huge.
Yeah.
This is millions and millions of people we're talking about. And to sort of get back to the first story, depending on what happens with ISIS and structurally in Syria, will we see this amount of refugees coming? I mean, they're coming.
Yeah.
Every day, there are more refugees being created. The longer the conflict goes on, everybody's wanting to get out, or the most people. So as to whether that dynamic will change, if we see ISIS, if not squashed completely, then sort of swept out of Syria to wherever, or crushed completely, this is just going to keep going. We're not going to see an end to this anytime soon until that happens.
Yeah, there'll be a huge humanitarian crisis to resolve if ISIS is gone.
Yep.
And if you're one of these people who are perhaps sitting at home, not that I'm saying our listeners are cold-hearted, but if you know someone who is saying, oh, we can't let these Syrian people come here, da-da-da-da-da, a photographer named Magnus Wenman did a series of photographs of the conditions that people in Syria, children of Syria, are finding themselves sleeping in, where they go to sleep at night. Some of them are just like on the ground with no blankets. Some of them are on the street. Some of them are, mattresses strewn about on the ground. It's really a heartbreaking series. So, if you're talking to a relative who is perhaps on the other side of this, you might want to look that up and send them a link. We will leave this topic there for next week. We'll undoubtedly keep talking about this. Anyway, we'll be back in a few with more topics and more news of the day. In the meantime, here is some music and some PSAs. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, your community station for over 30 years.
Let's go.
And that was just a taste of the Eagles of Death Metal. That's been in the station for about 10 years. I didn't realize they'd been around that long. And if that name sounds familiar to you, they were the band that were playing the Bataclan when everything happened in Paris. And miraculously, they all survived. But I guess they were able to go out the back or whatever. But
One of their roadies did die, though.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't totally unaffected by it. But it was surprising to hear that they all made it, because when you're up on the stage, you're right in the line of fire, as they say. But anyway, so that's it's almost unfortunate that that's the link as to why we played that song. But I was just myself curious as to what they sounded like, because they're not really death metal, or the Eagles for that matter, but sort of infamous now as opposed to just sort of a well-known band.
Yeah, they're kind of fun, and I listen to some of their songs, and it's kind of unfortunate that it takes
that's
a tragedy.
That's how we find out about them.
I find out this delightful little band called Eagles of Death Metal.
Do you remember that it was the worst fire in a club? Was it Great White or something? Who I'd never heard of. The nightclub that burnt down in the States, and there was like 90 people killed.
Oh, I can't.
I think it was
remember.
Great White was the name of the band. So it's like it's almost too bad, but we just happened to find that in the files and thought we'd play it. Just
we actually had an Eagles of Death Metal album, so
yeah,
that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
This is not cool.
No.
A new book appeared on Amazon at the end of last week. It was an e-book available for $7.77 that you could download on your Kindle. It was called A Mad World Order, and it was a spy thriller, kind of Tom Clancy-ish techno-thriller thing, 631 pages long, so it's quite the slog. The thing of it is, it was written by Paul Bernardo. And if you're thinking of it, maybe it was another Paul Bernardo. It hasn't been confirmed. But it does seem to be the case that this was a book written by the infamous serial killer, serial rapist Paul Bernardo, who was convicted to a life sentence 25 years ago, almost 25 years ago.
Jeez, it is too. That's right.
Yeah, it was 1990. He was arrested and then put on trial. And it is kind of, I mean, it's one of those visceral gut reaction things, like who would ever buy a book by Paul Bernardo? Who would ever let their company sell a book by Paul Bernardo? But the flip side of it is, at least from my point of view as a free speech advocate, is do we really want Amazon or any book retailer saying, no, we will not sell this book? No way, no how. We will vet all authors and see if they are appropriate to sell on our website or in our store or whatever. And I think that is the problematic part of this. Not that Paul Bernardo wrote a book, from which I gather...
lots of time on his hands.
Not lots of time on his hands. So you think there'd be some time for editing. I tweeted out a link to a Hamilton Spectator article where somebody actually reviewed the book. And it's apparently a spelling and grammar nightmare. Hmm. I will quote the review. There's a spelling mistake in the first sentence and most sentences after that. Bernardo can't grasp punctuation like hyphens and apostrophes, which becomes commas if you slide them down a little.
Hmm.
So,
zing, yeah.
That I find almost more egregious than the fact that Paul Bernardo's book was selling on Amazon. That it just, you know, he has all the time in the world, and he couldn't, give this thing a thorough editorial polish for spelling and grammar. But at 631 pages, does he think he's J.K. Rowling?
Or Stephen King, for that matter.
Yeah.
Well, this is the problem, and it's a good and a bad thing, in that, and you know, we're at the point now where self-publishing is just a matter of you don't have to go to anything involving paper. It's just, boom, it's uploaded. You can download your book at whatever price you like, $2.99. There's a certain degree of royalties to it. I know people were e-publishing and self-publishing, whatever, but I had no idea to what degree this existed. And I sort of agree with you a bit on the freedom of speech element, but there is a limit to that. And I mean, when your book is going on sale like this, it's a business. And if Kindle, Amazon is getting this much, they got so much blowback, they had to do something. They couldn't not do something. I mean, you could have published it as a book and sold it. I don't know who would sell it for them. They would probably end up not in trouble, but sort of vilified for doing that. But what I was really surprised at, and it sort of ties into why this book exists, is how many books there are about Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, not just on Amazon, but how many were written. I recall that first one, the famous one that had the pages blanked out in Canada, but not the American version, and people were looking up something. It was something new called the internet then, and you could get the missing pieces of the book. So, I mean, that's early foreshadowing as to the point where we are now, where any clown, or really good author, but in this case, clown, publishes a book of some kind. Now, it was interesting that the lawyer for the Mahaffey family, Tim Danzen, he's a name that you'd know because he's in the media quite a bit and was specifically with this, but he's done other high-profile cases too. He's at the point where he said he pretty much has to read it now because he's going to comb it for any references. If there's, you cannot profit if you're in jail from anything to do with your crime.
Right.
So whether if you were involved with a, let's just say the movie of the week or whatever involving what you did or this in Canada, you can't profit from that. And he doesn't, the first complaints I heard about this are, why does he have the internet? Why does he have email? He doesn't.
No.
He doesn't have it. He probably has a computer or something that he could chip this out on, which is going
or,
back.
Or
which
at least
is,
pen and paper.
Yeah. So you'd probably, it's the equivalent of having a typewriter. And of course he has TV in the news, so he would have some idea of world events. It's not as if this is just coming from a 1990 frame of reference. But all of that doesn't matter. I mean, it's the fact that it happened and that enough people were screaming at Amazon to take it down. It was on sale from June.
Yeah.
So it's not as if this is anything new, right?
Yeah.
It's not as if it was, ironically, sales went up when the story was broken. I think it was Global broke it initially.
Yeah.
So when that happened, it was like, everybody was like, ooh, I wonder what that's about. But it sounds like it's a piece of garbage.
Yeah.
So it's a piece of garbage in jail making garbage. There
you go. This review described all the various plot points. It involves Al-Qaeda. It involves the Freemasons. It involves the Russian mob. It involves the Illuminati, Skull and Bones, U.S. Special Forces. So hackers, like all your favorite conspiracy theory targets. So it's from the sounds of it, Paul Bernardo is spending all his time immersing himself in the truth or culture, and then punched out this 600-page piece of claptrap.
And he has to get it on paper because he doesn't have access to the internet. So he's getting his intel from somewhere. But
He's probably getting books, magazines, what have you, which as a prisoner you have a right to. The thing is with the. It became, you're right, it became a number one bestseller in the spy thriller subgenre section of Amazon and went to number one after this made the news. And then it was pulled. There are a couple of things. So first of all, Amazon said no comment when they were asked about it, and they've been asked repeatedly. Amazon just said, no comment. We're not talking about this anymore, before and after they pulled it. That kind of disturbs me because they have to say something about it. And then the other thing is, if you want stuff written by mass murderers or serial killers, Amazon can still help you out. There's books by John Wayne Gacy on Amazon. Mm-hmm. There's a book by Sam Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam. Of course, the big one, Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, you can buy. And you can actually go
written
downtown.
In jail, right?
You can go down to it was written in jail, you're right. You can go downtown to the bookshelf and buy it, too, for that matter. So, it comes back to me about the free speech thing. Why can you buy books by these guys? And then Paul Bernardo thinks he's, Jack Ryan or something, and then punches out something.
John Wayne Gacy's deceased, right? But Son of Sam, is he still alive? Or? Berkowitz is still alive. So would he probably, I don't know, I would think the rules in the States.
The rules in the States are probably different.
Yeah, but they may be similar, too, in that you can't profit from your crimes. So I think that's, I wouldn't say it's universal law, but.
No, that's a Canadian thing for sure.
Yeah, and what this reminded me of, actually, was when there was a point there, it's been a long-running kind of thing where the obsession with Charles Manson, and there were certain bands, Marilyn Manson in particular, covering Charles Manson songs because he's a bit of a songwriter. I would take it Manson's written some kind of a book, I don't know, Helter Skelter being the famous book about the case. And I'm sure Manson probably has way more books about him than Paul Bernardo does. But it's the same kind of thing. I mean, people are tuned into this kind of thing. And in some way, we want to hear these stories, always.
Mm-hmm.
But, should Charles Manson profit? Should Bernardo profit? Absolutely not. And it looks like if Danzen is on the case, and there's anything remotely to do with that, he's done. I mean, it was said that this will probably affect his incredibly slim chances at parole. He's not getting out just because of the scope of what happened and the reaction of Canadians. He is life is life for this guy.
Right.
It would be highly unlikely he's getting out of jail.
Even Carlo Homolka basically had to do a face off in order to live some semblance of a normal life when she was released. And by that I mean the John Woo movie where they take people's faces off and replace them with another face. Basically, that's how she lives on the QT. Nobody really knows where she lives either. And so
they track her down once, though, didn't they? Like they somehow managed to find her, and she was living in Quebec and
but
had a kid. And
there's a couple of theories about where she is now, but this is the thing is the families received form letters that he was applying 3 years in advance for parole, which is fairly typical. You know, once you're 3 years out from your end date, you can start getting the paperwork in motion. But it's incredibly, incredibly unlikely that he's going to walk into a parole board or in front of a judge, and judge is going to say, okay, here's your day pass. But
no, he's not getting out.
They gave that beheading guy, the guy who beheaded the bus passenger in Manitoba a couple of years ago, he got a day pass, so you never know.
But yeah, I think there's slightly different circumstances that he was having mental issues, right? Poor.
True.
I suppose Bernardo was too, but, you know, it's not our place to judge, but it's why they make these decisions. But I don't think that the beheading guy was just out and about roaming free.
No, no.
As free as possible, but
still.
Something to consider.
Yes, and we will consider now the Guelph budget. If you follow local news at all, you know that council is currently deliberating about the budget for fiscal 2016. There are a number of cuts on the table. As you may remember, Mayor Cam Guthrie promised or pledged in his election campaign to keep any tax increases at rate of inflation. He tasked city staff to keep that in mind. They came back with an initial budget estimate that would see a 1.58% increase over last year. There was a meeting last night where they announced a number of expansions or add-ons which could take it up to 2.83%, but still there are a number of cuts pending, or a number of new fees coming, or coming back as the case may be. One of them is taking away free parking on the streets of downtown, which you did have to pay to park on the streets of downtown several years ago, and then that was a pilot project that they deemed successful and made it semi-permanent. The more contentious bit, though, and this affects me as a transit user and a transit nerd, was to increase price of transit. It goes up a dollar, so it would be $4 to ride the bus one way, $5 extra dollars on regular passes, $2.50 on affordable bus passes, an increase there, plus a cut in service to 1 hour on Sundays, holidays, and on a summer schedule.
Yeah, and cuts on a Sunday don't make sense now because we're living in a very different world. I remember when Guelph didn't have a bus at all on a Sunday.
Yeah.
That's not that long ago. I mean, I'm not that old, but old enough. I remember when the bus... But, to service cuts like that are just... You know, they could probably toy around with some routes and maybe find savings there, but to cut everything universally... And holidays, that too, I mean, you can sort of see that. But the increase of the cash fare by a buck is just... I don't know. It's pointless. No one. I don't think. Well, it's not that there are people that have to take the bus, and then it's just some of the distances you take on the bus. So you're getting your $4 worth if you're going from, say, downtown just to the university. I don't know.
Well,
I don't think so.
The thing of it is, if
you don't have a choice, maybe that's.
Well, people who use the bus all the time. There are a couple of things about people who use the bus all the time that people may not realize.
Like Adam Donaldson.
Yeah. One of them is sometimes the bus doesn't come first thing on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to leave first thing on a Sunday morning in terms of the first bus out of the square. And I've gone to my bus stop and waited, and it never comes because somebody calls in sick or so they don't have enough drivers, or what happened about a month ago, which was there was this huge bus accident just outside downtown.
The early morning one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that threw the schedule off. The second thing is, and again, a lot of people who take the bus will recognize this. How many times do you get downtown just in time to see the bus you need to transfer to leave? That's a long half hour. if you're needing to get somewhere, on Sunday morning, there's not necessarily a lot open downtown, so you can just pop in and stay warm for a minute. And if you have to get to work, you know, how often is, the bus was late, going to be an acceptable excuse for your boss? And I'm forced to recall the lockout and people mm-hmm. talking about how they basically lost their jobs because they had no reliable way to get to work. But the city thought, well, that's okay because it's August, so very few people take the bus. Well, the people who have to take the bus in August have to take the bus. And it's the same thing on Sundays, too.
Yeah, to do the lockout in August was a bit of a student-centric thing. It's like, because if the students were in, it would have been complete and utter chaos. But chaos enough for working people and everybody else that takes the bus. I mean, it's not limited to students, although there are lots of them. Mm-hmm. My favorite part of this was the publishing of the simulation exercise. Yeah. And the cut. Where should the, they made a point of saying that, it's not statistically valid as what these numbers are. But, of course, what did people pick on that it would seem city council on the whole is afraid to touch? Is the police budget.
Yeah.
I said people would be happy with it. That was like an almost 5% cut in the police budget.
Yeah.
But of course, was it Salisbury that put forward a motion or something? Like, so, what can we do about this? And it was like, it sounds like it was the sound of crickets. It's like, nope.
Yeah.
We ain't touching that.
The police,
it's huge. The police budget is like, what, $38 million?
No matter what
they
municipality
can't find the savings.
You're in. Yeah, no matter what municipality you're in, the police budget is sacrosanct and it only ever goes up. And that is something I'll give Rob Ford credit for, is that saying, why is the, forcing the issue and saying, why is the police budget going up? Why is it when, like, violent crime is going down and we seem to be safer than ever, the police budget is going up?
Of course, the argument is violent crime's not gone down because the police budget is so high. But
well,
you can't win.
It's
they must
the egg.
Be able to find a saving somewhere, because we're talking about, with this service rationalization review, to spend mm-hmm. $450,000 to find $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's a bit warped. That's a bit warped too, in my view. I mean, does it really take that much to find that amount of saving? It's not minuscule by any means. And I understand when people say, "Well, why did they cut this and that?" I think they should take this statistical tool, the simulation exercise, like, truly and genuinely to the people and say, where would you like to see the cuts? Whether it's a referendum in the next, I know it's a bit late for the next municipal election,
yeah.
but you really find out what people's priorities are. When there is a group saying that, you should cut the police budget by this much, we'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
That's saying something, right? And where didn't they want the cuts? Of course, the library and transit, right?
Yeah, and there were people who wanted money invested. They wanted a general expansion of the capital budget, which primarily means the library. On the other hand, you had people saying, like, show some restraint about new projects. And
like the Niska Road Bridge. That's in a bone of contention.
It's a bone of contention because people think that if they widen the bridge, it's going to be more traffic. Well, I have news for you. There's more traffic. And, once you get out of your car, you recognize just how much traffic there is.
Yeah. I don't think legally they can slap in another Bailey Bridge as well. Like, when bridges are built and highways are modified now, there's a certain amount of, I guess that's why they do an environmental review too. There is a certain amount of clearance now, and distances and medians on the side that has to happen for safety reasons, right?
So. But the show some restraint comment, I mean, it demonstrates kind of a fundamental misunderstanding. It's not like the city's building new stuff, new buildings
vanity
on every
projects
corner. Yeah, and
yeah.
That was the big thing about the debate about the museum a couple of years ago, the new Civic Museum. It's like,
which people love.
People like, but there are a lot of people who are like, why are we dumping money in the museum? Even though a great portion of that was actually privately raised. There was a huge fundraising campaign to get money for the Civic Museum.
And that needs to be made clear.
Yeah.
Too,
absolutely.
Just, people just see it.
And the same thing
anything
for the market
happens,
square.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything happens, and that's my money. Well, we know the Jerry Baker's of the world. And we'll have you on next time, Jerry, if you're listening. When we talk budgets, I'd love to have you on. It'd be fantastic.
And the other thing, too, was people, the other cuts people wanted to make was city staff and city council and the mayor's paychecks.
How did that go over?
Yeah.
I missed that part. It's like, well,
yeah,
they just want everything cut. Just cut.
But,
cut.
Yeah. So
cut, cut, cut.
I I don't understand. You know, the counselors make a pittance for basically taking on another full time job.
That some needs of them to have change. Jobs. A lot of people are in agreement that absolutely.
And the mayor's on call 24 hours a day, yeah. 7 days a week.
And he's very good too. I mean, he is excellent at the response time and.
Yes, he's very good at outreach. Yeah. I give Mayor Camp definitely that credit. And then he says something like on the transit issue that service cuts must be weighed against the needs of affordability, whether you ride Guelph Transit or not. Well, I wonder how many people are going to get out and ride Guelph Transit when it costs more and you're getting less. That doesn't make a lick of sense to me. And I hate to come back to it, but this is like the Charlie Brown football gag every budget season. City staff comes down and says, okay, here's this football about cutting transit service. And it seems like city staff is going to keep bringing it in until council eventually goes, all right, we'll cut the service. And even though it defies complete and total logic of the modern world, where you have John Tory in Toronto saying, we need expanded service on Sunday. We need to start transit earlier, take it later. And
yeah, it's not 1950 anymore where everything was shut. Sorry, no. 1980-something where everything is closed on a Sunday. Yeah. I remember those days, but it's not the way now. I mean, people have places to go and
yeah, and some of them
things
are,
to do and jobs to get me. To and yeah. Day and night, 24/7.
Sometimes it's me and I flip a coin to see whether or not the bus is going to come at first thing on a Sunday morning. But enough about me.
We still love Guelph Transit, though.
Let's talk about
a personal critique.
Yeah. But. Let's talk about the show, because that's all for the show this week.
Really? Oh, we're done.
Well, you can stay connected to Open Sources all week long at our website, opensourcesguelph.com, as well as our Facebook page, Open Sources Newswire. Just look that up. And you can also go to Twitter at @OS_Guelph. And, of course, we are on Podbean as well, the Guelph Politicast channel, where you can hear all the latest episodes of Open Sources Guelph. And you can stay connected with me at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
I'm on Twitter, Scotty Hertz, Facebook, Scotty Hertz. And I promise this weekend, something on the Spanner book that I keep talking about and not doing anything about, there will be something there, I assure you, my fan who reads my blog. Hey, fan, there's going to be something there. So
you know what?
Thank you for reading.
You joke, but when you post those when you post it on the Facebook, they get a lot of hits. They do get hits.
I look at
the analytics. So people want to hear what you have to say off air.
That's wonderful. You need to show me these analytics because I'm just like, oh, you read my thing? Excellent.
So yeah, write this guy. I'm
not quite a Luddite yet, yeah, but
there you go.
I do work the controls. I can't smash them, you know. It's not on, but thank you for reading and thank you for listening too.
There you go. Scotty Hertz is not a Luddite on doing his blog and working on a radio show. Stay tuned
using
for DJ.
A computer.
Stay tuned for DJ Sense. Good to be here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Stay tuned for Al Jazeera, too. We'll be placing some news from Al Jazeera to lead you into Sounds Good to Me at the top of the hour. And we'll be here next week with more Open Sources, Thursdays at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Take care.